And our next case this morning is Gage versus Richardson.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Let's wait one moment until we change up the Zoom squares here. Okay. All right.
So this UG's office.
I think we've got just a substitution of counsel at the Department of Justice. All right, and there's Ms. Potts. Mr. Code, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Richard Code. I represent Patrick Gage, the appellant. The Wisconsin judicial system failed Patrick Gage. Gage was accused of sexually assaulting his daughter years before he was charged in court. And there are several key parts of these failures I'd like to focus on today. First, as to the substance here, Gage received the ineffective assistance of counsel. His lawyer interviewed zero witnesses. Gage was charged with one of the most serious offenses in the Wisconsin Code, and his lawyer didn't interview anyone, and that left two critical witnesses on the sideline at trial. Only one witness testified on behalf of the defense, and that was Gage himself. Second, in reviewing Gage's ineffective assistance of counsel claim for failure to investigate, the Wisconsin State Court of Appeals per curiam opinion stated the wrong Strickland standard for prejudice, one that this court has rebuked the Wisconsin State Court for more than once and other state courts. In its single paragraph of analysis of the failure to investigate claim, the few facts that it actually did consider were flawed. The analysis was flawed. And finally, today, I hope to be able to talk about the fact that because the Wisconsin Court of Appeals applied the wrong legal standard for prejudice, this court should not give it any deference under AEDPA. So moving to ineffective assistance, the State Court of Appeals opinion did not address deficient performance. That means we're in a de novo review here. I do think that the district court, however, provided a pretty thorough analysis of this prong of Strickland. I'll just touch on a couple things I think might be important for the court to consider. First, I think it's critical to look at what did the defense lawyer know prior to trial about the two witnesses I've identified here, which is Nancy and Josh Gage. Nancy Gage was Patrick Gage's mother, HG's grandmother, and Josh was HG's brother and Patrick Gage's son. And prior to trial, counsel knew that they all lived together. Every single time HG visited Patrick Gage, Josh Gage was there. And at least during the times when the visits were to Nancy Gage's house, Nancy Gage was there. Specifically, counsel knew that Josh had told the police in a police report that he had never witnessed any sexual abuse or anything suspicious to that end. He also knew that they all slept in the same general area. He knew that Nancy was very close with HG. And yet he didn't do the basic minimal work of a criminal defense lawyer. You have two witnesses who were with HG and Pat Gage every single time they were together, and HG claimed that almost every time Patrick Gage sexually abused her. And yet
the lawyer had some preview with respect to Josh, not Nancy, but the lawyer had some preview of what he might say through the police reports. And it wasn't necessarily favorable to your client. Why wouldn't that be a sufficient basis for him not to interview Josh?
Well, I guess I would disagree with that characterization insofar as he did have an indication that Josh had said he had never seen any kind of sexual abuse. That was in the police report. To me, as a defense lawyer, that's an automatic interview then, particularly with the nature of this case where the allegations were so far in the past and your lines of defense are so limited, you have to go interview that person, even if he might have said, well, I'm upset with my dad because of this. That doesn't mean you don't interview them. I think you have to go interview them. I want to know good and bad as a defense lawyer. I can't know that. I can't take at face value a police report. I've looked at plenty of police reports in my 16 years, and you can't take them at face value. And so your job as a defense lawyer is to investigate that lead. And at worst, I get the answer in the negative, right? That I've determined, okay, Josh is a dangerous witness. I'm not going there. But in this case, that the defense lawyer didn't do that. And I think the proof is in the pudding in terms of Josh's testimony at the post-conviction hearing. You don't know unless you interview someone what they're going to say. And I think that his testimony at the post-conviction hearing was entirely positive in favor of Mr. Gage. And I think, you know, what really I think should bother the court about on the deficiency prong was the circuit court in Juneau County echoed the defense lawyer's testimony saying, look, once counsel made the decision not to present Josh or Nancy as witnesses, well, then why bother interviewing them? It's a waste of time. And as this court has noted in Crisp v. Duckworth, that's an amazing statement. That is completely backwards. You can't make an informed, reasonable decision about a witness, putting on a witness, unless you do some minimal investigation. And I think the district court found at least pretty easily that there was deficient performance here.
That argument has to be contextualized within the facts of this case, as we know them to be based on the post-conviction hearing, the Mockner hearing. And that those facts are that the two witnesses that were omitted from the investigation, and it wasn't that they were entirely omitted from the defense attorney's investigation. The defense attorney, as Judge Saini even noted, had the police report about the investigator's interview with the brother, with Josh, and the defense attorney knew based on conversations with his client, or at least he so testified, that that what the mother would generally say, and determined that neither witness would be helpful. And we now know, and this bleeds into the prejudice analysis, but we now know that these two witnesses would not have added much given the nature of their testimony, which is to say that they were in the same house during the relevant period of years when the victim and her brother visited your client, and that they didn't see anything. That's of marginal evidentiary value. So given what the defense attorney did know, the failure to conduct a more formal interview, and it's my understanding that he testified that he spoke with both of these witnesses, but he didn't do a formal interview of them.
I actually disagree that that's an accurate summary of the testimony by the defense counsel. When asked directly, did you ever interview Nancy Gage? He said, no, I don't recall that. And when asked, did you ever speak with Josh Gage? He said, no. I don't think reading a police report is an investigation. I mean, I guess maybe that's part of it as well. I don't see it that way. And I think too, I guess I disagree with the import of their testimony. And I think it's critical to look at that, and this is Tolliver and Mosley, looking at it in the context of the state's proof. Here, the state's proof, all it was HG saying, hey, between 2 and 8 years ago, I was sexually abused by my dad almost every time I visited him. And so that leaves Mr. Gage in a position years later where he has no potential to have an alibi witness, no potential for an eyewitness, no physical evidence. His only real defense is to say, I didn't do that. And to have two witnesses to say, look, I mean, for Josh in particular, he narrows the time time frame where this could have happened, because he said, hey, I stayed up late. I stayed up till 1 to 3 in the morning playing video games every night. Nancy saying, hey, I went down into the basement to my sewing room or my quilting room until 11 o'clock at night, I would go down there. And that's where they were sleeping. And, even Nancy's testimony about, hey, I had a really close relationship with HG and I never saw anything amiss. I never saw any strange behavior. She had a normal father-daughter relationship. The jury heard none of that. All they heard was Pat Gage saying, I didn't do this. And I think that given when you're comparing the state's evidence, which is just a single statement by HG, to that type of testimony. I mean, look, the state put on HG's mom, so she wasn't alone. When you compare those and you add those up, sure, in other types of cases, in the context of other types of cases where there's physical evidence, eyewitnesses, alibi witnesses, maybe this testimony wouldn't have been valuable. But in the context of this particular case, I think it was critical. And I think, you know, you saw it. Look, the jury acquitted on count one. There were issues here, I think, with HG's credibility. And any evidence, any witness statement that would tend to hurt her credibility or help Mr. Gage's credibility was critical. And the defense lawyer really did nothing.
What is it about Josh's testimony? You've noted that he testified he was up until 1 or 3 every night playing video games, but HG said this happened at night after everybody was asleep. What else is it about Josh's testimony that you think conflicts with HG's?
Well, I think in particular, and I think the Court of Appeals got this wrong, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, Josh, you know, HG said, look, sometimes we slept in the bedroom, sometimes we slept on the couch, and made it, the testimony sounded like it was sort of a varied thing. And so that would open up opportunities for Mr. Gage to act in this manner, as he alleged. But what Josh testified was, look, no, I don't even remember her sleeping in the bedroom.
But wasn't that testimony only relevant to count one, which he was acquitted on?
That in particular, yes. But Josh said, I usually slept on the couch, which is where count two was. And when pressed, he said, well, maybe like 1 or 2 times I slept in a bedroom, but I almost always slept on the couch. And that's not what the testimony was at trial from HG. I think the, you know, narrowing that window, Josh would have testified, hey, my dad fell asleep in the recliner at 8 o'clock every night. Heather or HG went to bed after that. I went to bed way later than that. That at the very least is narrowing, you know, all she testified to was it happened at night. She didn't say what time, she didn't say the early morning hours or 4 a.m. or 5 a.m.
But she said at night after everybody went to sleep.
She said at night. I don't know that, I can't say my recollection of the record.
I think she said when everybody was sleeping. That came out in the testimony.
So look, at the very least, Josh's testimony would eliminate 8 p.m. to 3 a.m. or 1 a.m. every day. And I think it's, you know, his testimony about the cabin, I think, was very critical as well. It's a one-room cabin with a loft. And he said, I would have heard everything. I heard people talking. There's a creaky ladder. And the allegation from the cabin, you know, I think it, look, it's, it goes back to, Mr. Gage is not in a position where he could say, hey, on May 15th of 2002, this is what was going on in my house, because the allegations weren't that specific. And so any testimony that would cast some doubt on HG's story was critical. That's why the trial counsel was deficient, and that's why Gage was prejudiced. I think too, you have to, in looking at the Wisconsin Court of Appeals opinion, why I don't think this court should give it any deference, cited the wrong legal standard. It cited a case that also cited the wrong legal standard. And the analysis was so cursory. There were 3 pieces of what I would call contested evidence that it considered. And I don't think it's a matter of opinion, as Richardson suggests. I think it got those 2 of those 3 pieces of testimony wrong. One, what we've already covered, which is the couch versus the bedroom. Two, you know, it didn't consider that Josh generally last or went to bed last and was it was at 1 or 3 in the morning. It didn't give that level of detail. And number three, it stated that the Court of Appeals opinion stated that Nancy was not generally in the basement at night, and that's wrong. She testified, the record site is R1017, page 91, that she would routinely go down into the basement until 11 o'clock at night to go to her quilting room. And so I don't think that there's any substantive analysis in the per curiam opinion from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals that would is worthy of this court's deference. It's the wrong legal standard. It's a cursory analysis, and it didn't discuss the context, which is critical, as we know from Mosley and Tolliver, of the state's evidence and the relative strength or weakness of the state's case. And it also didn't discuss the cumulative nature of the testimony from Nancy and Josh. And it left out, as the district court pointed out, a lot of pieces of their testimony that are important, particularly when you consider them in a cumulative nature. Again, this is a case where there's just a statement from a person. There is no other evidence. And to discount Josh and Nancy's potential impact on this outcome was wrong.
Mr. Cote, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Potts.
You're muted.
Still muted.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Abigail Potts. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Wisconsin Department of Justice, and I represent the respondent appellee. Mr. Gage does a really good job painting a picture of a situation where a trial attorney completely disregarded two key witnesses. But the problem with his case is that the actual record tells a very different story. And with that in mind, there's two main things I want to address this morning, basically just clarifying the two prongs of Strickland as applied to this case. One, I want to briefly discuss prejudice because this case can begin and end on the prejudice prong of Strickland. And secondly, I want to take a little bit of time to talk about deficient performance from our perspective because that is the prong about which I think a lot of the facts and the record have been a little bit distorted. And it's the prong that I think the district court simply got wrong by not affording proper deference under Strickland to a tactical decision of trial counsel. So I'll start with prejudice, and I think this is the prong that this prong really comes down, as we all know, to the Mockner hearing testimony of Josh and Nancy and what came out at that hearing. It is the state's position that the insignificant nature of that testimony, of Josh and Nancy's testimony, made it well within the confines of reasonable for the state court of appeals to determine that their testimony did not create a reasonable probability of a different result at trial. And one of the key facts in the record, I think, that really bolsters this finding and this decision by the state court is the fact that at closing argument, trial counsel consciously and expressly pointed out to the jury that neither Josh nor Nancy testified on behalf of the state. So what trial counsel was doing, and we know this from the Mockner hearing testimony by trial counsel, is he was raising for the jury the fact that Josh and Nancy could not support these charges. So the jury knew that. And we know from the Mockner hearing testimony from Attorney Burkos as well, that he did this consciously because he thought he could get the same benefit out of that inference that he could get by calling them as witnesses without the possible detriment that those witnesses could cause. So we know that the jury heard that. We know that the jury, when they were deliberating, knew that neither Josh nor Nancy could support the state's case.
Didn't both sides attempt to exploit the evidentiary gap in closing?
That's true. They did. They both used it in their own way. The state also said, well, you didn't put them on either. But I think that what that shows for a jury is that they didn't have something to provide. And what we see in the Mockner hearing is exactly that play out. Josh and Nancy's testimony ended up being precisely what Attorney Burkos thought it was going to be. And I think sometimes, you know, Mr. Gage does a good job trying to really parse out and find any possible discrepancy between Josh's testimony and the victim's testimony. But when you really go back and you read that transcript, Josh is testifying in a rather reluctant way. He is not offering up alibi witness testimony. He is not offering up any strong defense of his father. He is being led by both attorneys, and basically says he didn't see anything. And that is something that the jury basically already knew because the state did not use them. And so I think that just adds to, that is a fact in the record that adds to the reasonableness of the state court's decision. And I think it is important to remember that we are under AEDPA for this, that we, the prejudice.
Did we really draw that conclusion though, that the jury made that determination? When I'm sure they were instructed to decide this case only on the evidence presented in the courtroom. And
sure,
you're talking about attorney argument now. There was no evidence presented one way or the other about what Josh and Nancy saw or heard. So how can we draw that particular conclusion?
No, we don't know. You're right, Your Honor. We don't know exactly what was in the minds of the jurors when they were considering this evidence. But what we do know is that it was brought to their attention that they were not used by the state in support of its case. And this kind of also touches on the deficient performance prong, which we can get to in a minute, but this came out at the Mockner hearing that this was a conscious decision by trial counsel to alert the jury of that fact. And I think—
Isn't that a performance prong as opposed to a prejudice prong argument?
Yeah, you're right. It's related to both of them. The attorney's decision to raise that with the jury goes to his trial tactics on how he wanted to present that evidence. But I think it's also important to know that there was a discussion by both sides in front of the jury that highlighted the fact that Josh and Nancy were not called as witnesses. And what that relates to is just more generally that everything that was said, basically everything that was testified to by Nancy and Josh, basically comes down to we didn't see anything. We didn't know anything was going on. That's all. There's nothing more in their testimony except for small discrepancies between what Josh describes, you know, the layout of the house. But I think in some ways, I think those get very overblown in the briefing, because when you really read the Mockner hearing transcript, you see that Josh acknowledges he's speaking in generalities. He's saying generally, I don't remember every time. So he by no means says absolutely every time I slept on the couch or absolutely every time the victim slept on the couch. That's just not what the testimony says. And it's also not the nature of the testimony. The testimony itself is quite, I find it quite reluctant. It is not glowing. It's not a major defense of his father. So I think there is plenty in the record to uphold the state court's decision on the prejudice prong, especially under in the habeas context that we're in and under AEDPA.
What about now, the cumulative impact of both Josh and Nancy saying that they didn't see anything? I think you would agree this trial appears to have come down to credibility. Do they believe HG? Do they believe Mr. Gage? Why wouldn't the cumulative impact of Josh and Nancy, who from all the testimony were around or in the home at the time this was going on, asleep but in the home, why would their cumulative testimony impact the prejudice prong?
A couple of reasons. The first is that from reading the trial transcript, you see how credible the victim comes across. She gives lengthy testimony. She is bright. She is articulate. She is specific in ways that Josh's Lochner hearing testimony is not. Her testimony is just far more specific and substantive, even going down to talking about how her dad psychologically changed over time in terms of the assaults. So there's a lot of substance to her testimony. And Nancy and Josh, again, I kind of referenced the fact that the jury was aware that they did not testify on behalf of the state. I think it's pretty fair to assume that they could then assume that, they couldn't say they saw something. And so I think the critical components of their testimony were already aware or before the court, the jury was already aware of them. So I think it was very reasonable of both the state circuit court and the state court of appeals to find that they don't, and the district court in this case, so three courts to find that there was not a reasonable probability that their testimony would have affected the outcome. And I think that has to do with the lack of substance from Josh and Nancy's testimony in general. I think it has to do with the credible nature and the substance of the victim's testimony. And I think that's what the court saw, is they just saw that after the Mochner hearing, everybody realized that Josh and Nancy testified to pretty much exactly what Attorney Burgos thought they were going to, which was not much.
Mr. Crowe said that we should not give the prejudice analysis of the Court of Appeals AEDPA deference because of the court's statement of the legal standard.
Yes, and we disagree, obviously, and as we've said in the brief, and I would say that...
You agree that the legal standard was misstated, or you disagree that the decision doesn't get deference?
That's a good question. In our brief, we acknowledge that the court misstated it, although, to be honest with you, Your Honor, in preparing even more for argument and rereading all the cases that you got that the Seventh Circuit has issued on this decision, I don't entirely think that the standard cited by the State Court of Appeals is wrong, and I'll tell you why. I think that what the cases say that find an incorrect standard being cited is that the court is applying an extra burden on a defendant to show that the trial or the process was fundamentally unfair, unreliable. What the state court did in this case was basically say what is said in Strickland, which is it's rendering unreliable the outcome. And I think the difference is outcome versus process. So while I completely agree, and the state agrees, that it would have been better for the State Court of Appeals, to simply cite Strickland and the more common language on that, I think that the standard is not actually substantively wrong, because what it's asking is, does it make the outcome, the conviction, unreliable? And well, Strickland itself...
Of an additional finding that the trial was fundamentally unfair?
It doesn't use that language.
That would have been a heightened burden?
Yes. Yeah, under the case law...
Was not.
I'm sorry, say that one more time, Your Honor.
Adding the component of fundamental unfairness imposes a heightened burden in a way that phrasing the standard as one of an unreliable verdict is not a heightened standard.
I would agree with that, and I would add that I think it also is relevant to talk about what is unreliable. If it said that the trial itself is unreliable somehow as a process, I think that adds another level of burden. But bringing into question the credibility or the reliability of the conviction is absolutely what Strickland wants you to do. We're not asking the defendant to show that it absolutely would have had a different outcome. No, it's a reasonable probability of a different result. That means, is it going to affect the outcome? Did it have any effect on the outcome? And that's essentially what the court stated as its standard. And then it's from the state's position that even if this court thinks that the standard that it cited is wrong, it applied the standard that is put forth in Strickland, which is it looked at the evidence from the Mockner hearing, it applied it to the evidence from trial, and it decided whether it was going to have an impact on the outcome, and it decided it didn't. Now, I'm not going to say that the Court of Appeals decision was the most thorough and well-analyzed decision that we've seen. It was short, it was fairly succinct, and but it was, I simply don't think you can say that it was contrary to Strickland at all, because it did exactly what Strickland wants you to do, which is look at the new evidence in light of the old evidence, and what kind of effect does that have on the outcome?
I think Mr. Code's backup argument is that even if this isn't contrary to Strickland, based on the statement of the prejudice standard, then it's an unreasonable application of Strickland.
Sure, and I would respond by saying I don't think it is. What they did is they looked, the court is not obligated to cite every single piece of testimony from the trial and the Mockner hearing and compare them all. What the court did is it looked at them, it stood back, it gave a kind of a global view of the testimony. It pointed out some specifics that it said, look, most of the testimony is fairly consistent. Some of it actually corroborates each other. There's minor differences, but nothing significant. So that is what they're supposed to do. They probably could have done it even better. Actually, they could have done it even better. But I think it withstands scrutiny at this level under habeas, and it should be afforded AEDPA deference on the prejudice prong. And then I'm almost out of time, but I'll just say that it's also the state's position that there was not deficient performance in this case either. And I'm out of time, so I will stop there.
All right, thank you very much. Mr. Code, I think you had used all of your time, but you may have a minute in rebuttal if you have anything like to.
I appreciate that. And I'll get right to the heart of prejudice here. There's one thing that the Juneau County Circuit Court got right, in my opinion, in the post-conviction hearing, and it was when it found, and this is a quote, this was a credibility case, and Nancy's testimony, if believed by the jury, would have undermined the credibility of HG. And then it said, well, gee whiz, I'm not gonna sit here and say, well, gee whiz, maybe he should have called her, maybe things would have been different. That's not the test this court has to follow. Well, that's exactly what courts should do on a post-conviction motion like this. And that was the judge who sat there and watched Nancy and Josh testify and judged their credibility and judged that Nancy would have hurt HG's credibility, and that wasn't brought to the jury. In terms of AEDPA, I think deference, the state or Richardson is absolutely wrong. This court has said in Washington v. Smith, Mosley v. Atchison, that stating the wrong legal standard and applying the wrong legal standard, that this court should not give deference. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.